In this chaotic political year, no matter which party you favor or which candidate you support, it's quite possible you agree on one thing with people you might otherwise find objectionable. The media is failing in its coverage of the 2016 election. At VPR, we've been getting a slew of email and messages from people who believe either A, there's been too much coverage of Donald Trump, B, there hasn't been enough coverage of Bernie Sanders, See, what coverage there is of Sanders is slanted negatively to favor Hillary Clinton. D, VPR is in the bag for Sanders because he's from Vermont and is liberal. Or E, some variation on all of the above. A lot of negative mail has also come our way regarding NPR's national coverage of the candidates. And so today we're speaking with David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent and author of the book Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. David Folkenflik, thank you so much for speaking with us.
What a pleasure to join you.
I want to start by reading just a few snippets of some angry emails we've had at VPR recently. I know, you're looking forward to this. Here's one. I am so sick of the fact that you have become just like the rest of the media, covering the election as though Hillary Clinton is the only Democratic candidate to mention, and Donald Trump is worthy of more coverage than any other candidate. Here's another. All comparisons with the Republican side are made with only Clinton when, in fact, national polls are showing Sanders doing better with women and better against Trump. But most people don't know this because the media has gotten behind this one candidate declaration. Now, there's more, but the general idea seems to be that NPR is giving Sanders a bit of a brush off. Have you been seeing similar mail from listeners directly regarding NPR's coverage of Bernie Sanders?
I haven't, and I want to start by not only thanking you for the opportunity to talk, but also by differentiating my role. So I'm the media correspondent for NPR, and that means I'm both the media reporter and media critic for the network. I'm paid by the network and happy to accept its money. But that said, I don't speak for the network. I critique the media writ large, and sometimes I critique NPR too. And they get to sort of justify the executives of the network, what they do. But I also get to analyze how this plays out. So let's look a little bit. One very small measure, for example, of how things work. I took a look at this before knowing I'd come on the show. Bernie Sanders has been interviewed three times in the course of this presidential campaign on NPR. In March on All Things Considered, in Morning Edition back in November, and in June, back in June on Morning Edition. Hillary Clinton's only come on once. Now, I'm sure that NPR would have liked to have interviewed her more time. I think that's what she's been willing to do. But those interviews are major moments. We build a lot of coverage around those interviews, and we try to elicit as much serious material as we can. As one very small measure, that's one way in which, in fact, Sanders has been favorably or at least more concretely presented on the network. I would say that NPR, as with a lot of major outlets, initially saw Bernie Sanders very much as a long shot. I would say that people looked at Hillary Clinton's acquisition of money up front, her almost blanket name recognition throughout the country, the familiarity with her over decades-long presence in public life, the tacit support clearly of President Obama and the explicit support of her husband, ex-President Bill Clinton, her role at the State Department and in the Senate, having built up a public record of her own apart from her presentation as First Lady. People looked at that and said, well, that's formidable. And in fact, people like Vice President Joe Biden looked at the field even with his own ambitions and thought the same. You know, she didn't attract what would have been at the time considered a blue chip field of contenders to go against her, perhaps a younger roster of contenders. And part of that might be the weakness of the Democratic gubernatorial or senatorial field, whatever. But they looked at that and said, gosh, this guy Sanders, he's from a small population state, very much on the left of the Democratic caucus in Congress. This guy isn't going to go anywhere. And in the early outset, they really, I think, the press tended to minimize what his potential could be. I think over time, people have reported on the surge of support that he's gotten from voters. There's the small donations and also just the boisterous, enthusiastic crowds. But there are ways in which I agree with critique, and we can talk a bit more about that as we continue. But there are ways in which I think that the press was following. You know, if you ever look at a mutual fund, it'll say past performance is no guarantee of future results. Well, the political press often looks at past performance and tries to tease out indications. And they tend to look at endorsements and money and name recognition and record. All of those things seem to vitiate in Hillary Clinton's favor. And let's be clear. Right now, even with all the support and all the votes and all the donations that Bernie Sanders has gotten in recent months, it still seems very strongly perhaps not prohibitively, but very strongly in Hillary Clinton's favor to secure this nomination.
That is something I want to get into in a moment, talking about her lead in delegates and such. But I think one of the things, and it's interesting you point out that Bernie has been on NPR more than Hillary has, one of the things I think people were reacting to was interviews with some of NPR's political correspondents. Mara Liasson said something about Hillary Clinton is essentially running against herself. And I think I know what she meant by that, meaning that she can be her own worst enemy. But people took that to mean that, oh, Bernie Sanders is not even a factor. And there was a lot of criticism that came in from that. Do you think the way that Bernie is talked about by some of the political correspondents on NPR or other media outlets is part of what's generating some of this negative reaction from listeners?
Sure. Mara's very sharp. I mean, I don't want to speak for her, but what I took from that when she said that, it wasn't language saying Hillary Clinton is running against herself to diminish Sanders, but she was suggesting, whether or not you agree with it, that in a sense that the vote, at least early on, was a referendum on Hillary Clinton herself, and therefore a vote for a candidate not being Hillary Clinton was a vote against her, not a vote as much for Bernie Sanders, Martin O'Malley, if you recall, or a Jim Webb back when they were in the race. And she may have been wrong about that, but I don't think she was saying that Bernie Sanders was nothing, but just that, you know, Hillary Clinton was such a known figure that for many people they would vote for her and many people would vote against her as opposed to for the other candidates. Now, I think that time has borne that out not to be the case. I think there are people who are genuinely deeply excited about Bernie Sanders, and I think that the campaign has shown that. I also think these things are not static. That is, what might have been true in June might be a little different now. And therefore, you know, something that somebody perceives to be the case as an analyst and as a reporter might look different to them some months later. And therefore, you know, simply saying, well, you're being inconsistent doesn't acknowledge that the path moves and the story changes. Even as I don't think that that particular assessment holds up all that well to scrutiny over time.
What about this idea that Hillary Clinton has this big lead in delegates, and she certainly has won more states and bigger states than Bernie Sanders has to this point. But a lot of people have been upset saying that when they hear commentators or political analysts talking about that lead, that they're including automatically and not mentioning the superdelegates, who, of course, can pledge to whomever they want come the convention, and that if you take away that superdelegate factor, that her lead over Bernie Sanders isn't quite that large.
Well, you know, there's truth to this. You could argue that we should be reporting on only the delegates and not who wins this state or that, because many of the states are not winner-take-all, and that they're fundamentally different contests for the convention. The party convention than states that distribute them by congressional district or states that apportion them quite differently or caucuses, which are just a mess, to be honest. The more you look at it, the less transparent they are and the less democratic small d they appear to be, even as I think they're fun and fascinating and interesting and tease out interesting themes in places like Iowa and Nevada. They're just not transparent. It's not clear how they really function. All of that said, really what you're talking about are people arguing for their own side. I've seen Clinton supporters do this in one way when things go cut one way. I've seen Sanders supporters do it when they cut another way. And I've seen this race after race, cycle after cycle. Essentially, you call it working the refs. Oh my gosh, you're not calling offsides. How can you know, in a football game, you say that to a ref long enough, suddenly the ref is really looking at offsides. Well, that's not to say they are wrong to do so. They are partisans. They are supporters. They are invested in this case, perhaps, in Senator Sanders' welfare and fate and fortunes. And that's totally fine for them to do. You know, I don't think the press should be apportioning minute by minute, moment by moment coverage on the basis of exactly the ratio of the advantage he or she might have or might be running up against when it comes to the delegate count or the vote count. I think that there should be a full complement of coverage of all the candidates with any kind of viable opportunity in these races, and that you've seen one of the least symmetrical races in quite some time happening in some ways because of what's happening on the other party, because of what's happening with Donald Trump. But Hillary Clinton is clearly getting the lion's share of the coverage, but not exclusively. There has been a fair amount of coverage of what's going on the Democratic side. I think you've seen Hillary and Sanders been teased out a lot more when Trump is a lot less noisy and is not making incredible controversies. But it has sucked up a lot of the available oxygen. I think in some ways that has benefited Hillary Clinton, because what Bernie Sanders needs is energy and coverage and attention to try to undermine the idea that Hillary Clinton is somehow the inevitable nominee. And I think the press has struggled with Sanders because he's an unconventional figure.
Well, David, you mentioned the D word. We made it this far into the interview without getting to Donald Trump, but there it is. The Donald Trump phenomenon, we do get a lot of mail saying you, the media, they may not mean VPR or NPR specifically, but they say you've created this guy. You keep giving him the attention, and that's why he's become this, in some ways, unstoppable behemoth that some people think he is. Has the media given too much attention to Donald Trump?
You know, I quarrel less with the amount of attention, although it is galactically disproportionate to Trump and for any other candidate in the race. And, there was one study showing that he had gotten more coverage on the major broadcast evening networks, that is the old legacy newscasts, ABC, CBS, NBC, than all of the other political candidates combined for the first 3 months of this year. That's extraordinary. On the other hand, he's clearly the most newsworthy. He knows how to make news. He knows how to own it. He does things outside of the news cycle on social media, or he makes statements, or he creates controversies that just completely undermine the ability of other candidates to get their footing. I think Marco Rubio in particular suffered from this. Every time it looked like Rubio was going to stick his head above water and make some real progress, he managed to come up with some positive or even at times negative news that would get attention simply to Trump. And for Trump, sometimes the negative coverage was fine because it would distract the public's attention because of the and as a great consequence, the media's attention from the other candidates and what they were trying to make news with. I think Bernie Sanders, weirdly, Bernie Sanders is an unusual candidate, right? He would be the first Jewish nominee. We don't talk about that a lot.
That's right. But, yeah. Neither does he, to be fair. He doesn't like to bring it up very much himself.
Absolutely true. And he's interested, I think, interestingly and poignantly about the question of faith when asked by CNN's Chris Cuomo, among others. But that said, it is a fact that that's the case. He would be an outer borough here in New York. We talk about the outer boroughs, meaning not Manhattan, from Brooklyn, my mother's native land. He would be a very interesting figure. And he's, a guy who calls himself a socialist. We have not had a major presidential candidate, I don't know whether since Eugene Debs or something, who embraces that mantle. These are really interesting things, and he's got a lot of people who believe in him and who are supporting him even when he embraces mantle that people would run from in decades past, I think in part because of the political moment we're in, in part because of the financial crisis and the dissolution of trust in institutions and particularly our financial markets and mechanisms. But that's a huge story. Trump has managed to tamp that down as a story.
How has he done that? How has Trump managed to tamp down that very interesting narrative you just talked about with Bernie Sanders? Because it is fascinating.
I think it's a really interesting story, and yet it is sort of the A-minus or B-plus storyline to Donald Trump. And you have a choice of two ways of looking at it. He's either exposing these almost calamitous fissures within the Republican Party, or he's dynamiting and creating them himself. And what Trump is doing is threatening the cohesion of the very creaky and internally contradicting nature of the present-day Republican Party. And you've seen this play out in the House of Representatives, where a very conservative leadership is stymied by a far more conservative rump group. And they're unable to do things that would allow the government to function except with dealing with threats of extortion within the House of Representatives. And you've seen this play out in recent years, probably since, call it, especially 2011. What Trump has done is say, you know what? There are a lot of folks who may identify themselves as Republicans who actually aren't desperate to have taxes cut in the most wealthy and who aren't looking for slashes in Social Security, but aren't in favor of business-endorsed proposals to ease immigration restrictions. In fact, would rather impose big ones. But they're people who might think that they're getting horribly treated by big government and by big corporations and by the markets. And Donald Trump is articulating that even as he contradicts himself every second or third day in how he would go about doing what he claims he would do. And so that's just a huge story. And it's exposing the inability of the Republican Party to figure out how to deal with it, the inability of any other candidate, and what looked like a fairly serious field. You had, you know, governors who had been elected multiple times to large states. You had Scott Walker, who looked like this union slayer from Wisconsin. You had Marco Rubio, the young Reagan, the young conservative Obama from Florida, could have been the first Latino major party nominee. Like, there are some really compelling storylines, and Trump just knocked them all out.
It is an astonishing story, but again, you know, that anti-corporate message that you talked about Trump bringing, of course, and this point has been made, that is Bernie Sanders' central message. He's putting that narrative out there, and I'm wondering about the media coverage looking at Trump and saying, this isn't just about him making news. This is about us getting eyeballs. This is about us getting clicks on our website, because every time he says something outrageous, that does translate, for better or for worse, of more coverage. I mean, CNN, and I'm sure you're aware of this, recently elected to broadcast an empty podium on a stage where Donald Trump was going to speak, and they kept it there for quite some time, rather than covering a speech that Bernie Sanders was actually making at the same time. I'm not sure that that's a defensible thing, is it?
I sure wouldn't defend it. The way it's defensible is by virtue of the fact that I think that CNN is going to enjoy a real surge in profits over the course of this presidential season, and that this has just been a huge boon for you've seen MSNBC go all in on this. You know, they are showing Trump. Here's the thing about Trump. You have no idea what the guy is going to say next. And if you talk to television executives and programmers, they will tell you the reason why sporting events generate such high licensing fees, why they pay the NFL and Major League Baseball huge dollar figures to get their major marquee events on the air, is you don't know how the event will end. So as long as it's not a blowout in the first quarter, you know, people will stick around to watch what happens.
As Bob Costas called it, unscripted drama as sports.
Right.
Yeah.
So Donald Trump is unscripted drama. That guy talks without teleprompters. He's just talking off the cuff. He often contradicts himself in the same speech. He sometimes says something, you know, really offensive, or if he can get somebody else to say something really offensive, he'll just quote them as though he's retweeting them, you know, but in person on national television. And, you know, it may create huge headlines and be, you know, great moments. They want that videotape live because people tune in. We tune in as a country far more to him than we do to almost anyone else. And that's just undeniable, and they are picking up on that. I swear to God, if CNN could get better ratings from people reading aloud from Jane Austen novels, they would do it.
But you can see how people would become cynical then about the media and say, look, yeah, we see what you're doing. This is great for your bottom line, but it's not great for our democracy. It's not great for an informed public.
I have all kinds of problems with the way in which this has played out. I think that the media has both missed the rise of Donald Trump on the front end, sometimes it kind of in the fall, as the blog 538 point, kind of missed how Trump plateaued and started to sag a bit until you saw the terrorist acts in San Bernardino and Paris, more recently in Belgium. I think that the press also very much helped to enable him. And the reason they helped to enable him is by these live, long, lingering shots of just him talking at will and taking him by cell phone on an almost daily basis. In some ways, it's great that he's making himself available to the press. In other ways, he simply talks over the press. He doesn't really listen to the questions. He doesn't certainly barely answers them. He often barely answers the category of question, much less the actual question. And it's not surrounded by coverage. You know, if you're going to treat him seriously, you need to cover early on and frequently a lot of different aspects of his business life and his life as an entertainer. You know, the question of how workers were treated on his projects, the question of those four bankruptcies, which he dismisses as, hey, just, that's the way business is done. Well, I want to understand those things because, you know what? This guy's never been elected anything. So we don't have that record to vet. I want to really understand the details, how he took advantage of the law, what he was doing, what that reflected about his business judgment, what that reflected about his willingness to let people he owed money to walk away with, you know, dimes on the dollar, if that. You know, the ways in which he pushed levers in city halls and in state capitals to try to get his way as he tried to create various you know, resorts or hotels or casinos. All of these things, all of that deserves very serious coverage for early on. The Washington Post did a few nice jobs early, you know, in this presidential season, but a lot of major news organizations did not. And I think that's a terrible failing. And simply allowing a guy to talk unfiltered at great length and not surrounding it with enterprise reporting, skeptical reporting, deep probing questions in ways in which Marco Rubio, you know, how he seems to have overspent on Republican state party credit cards in Florida got much earlier and much more serious coverage than anything Trump really did because they thought it was a lark. Now, Bernie Sanders, I think, the public editor, who's really the ombudsman of the New York Times, Margaret Sullivan, has done two columns so far already in this season about whether Bernie Sanders has been given short shrift. Early on, it was Sanders not getting enough coverage? More recently, in the last few weeks, she did a column saying, you know, did the New York Times re-edit a story about his legislative record and accomplishment in Congress to get in some Snyder, more negative filtering of that record? And I thought the article as it originally ran was pretty interesting because it talked about how, despite his rhetoric, he was willing to work to achieve more modest accomplishments and get things done in certain instances than he was to simply be adamant that everything be done his own way.
Kind of like a conventional politician would, yeah.
Yeah, but something that he really valued and you know, that a guy in his ideological position would value getting done nonetheless. The later version that appeared in print, subsequently edited by senior editors, made clear that it was unlikely he would succeed in his bid to become the nominee, and also, you know, indicated, well, you know, this is very different than the pie-in-the-sky kind of proposals. He wants universal health care, Medicare for all, free college tuition, a bunch of other things that really seem to expand the borders of the great society and of the social welfare state or the welfare net. I did think that the way in which that article was inappropriate, I don't think it's because editors are sitting there saying, how can we help Hillary? I think they feel as though at this point in the race, they need to inject a dose of realism. You know, if Martin O'Malley were still running for office, he could still be running for office, but they would have to say the guy's polling at 3% and he has, you know, essentially four delegates and it's just not going to happen. But, you know, O'Malley isn't. Sanders does have certain kinds of mathematical or delegate possibilities of getting there. And I think he should be treated thoughtfully and seriously and critically and with real scrutiny, too.
David, I mentioned that you're the author of the book Murdoch's World, Last of the Old Media Empires. And it's been interesting to me how Fox News has seemingly struggled with the Donald Trump phenomenon as well. And, you know, at the beginning, you would think they'd be natural allies in some ways, similar philosophies, it seems. But has Fox struggled with how to deal with Donald Trump, or are they benefiting from a lot of these, you know, well-chronicled battles with folks like Megyn Kelly?
Can we tick off all of the above?
Sure, why not?
You know, I think that that Fox News has struggled mightily and has caused deep divisions inside Fox News, both among its on-air talent and in the executive suites as well. Fox News did as much as anyone to pump up Trump as a serious figure that one needed to listen to on matters of public affairs. I think they treated him especially seriously, although NBC did as well. They treated Trump especially seriously when he was in his birther phase, and he was questioning the president's very, you know, Americanness, saying that Obama had, he believed, been born in Kenya, and he was sending out investigators to Hawaii, much like OJ was apparently going door to door to see who the killer of his former wife was. Well, Donald Trump was sending a team of investigators to Hawaii to find out the real story. The real story is the story. Barack Obama was born, you know, a United States citizen in an American state of Hawaii, and there's no doubt about that. And Donald Trump was saying something that tapped into a lot of racial resentments about President Obama as the first African-American president and stressing his father's background as a Kenyan. I think Fox was happy to have Donald Trump talk in that way and happy to have a guy who's as bombastic as he is, as unfiltered as Trump is, as unpredictable as Trump is, to come on the air, much in the way that Howard Stern had Trump on frequently over the years. When Donald Trump was actually starting to run for office, it was fun for them. He is more hostile to immigration than Roger Ailes ultimately is, but Ailes kind of likes having people on the air who are hostile to it. It's red meat for a lot of their core audience, a lot of the core of certain older, particularly white male viewers that Fox has. Fox has an exceptionally old demographic. If you look at, I think that the average age of its viewership is over 66 years old. I mean, it's 50% of its viewers are more than the age of 66 years old. And there's a its audience particularly skews into concerns about immigration. That said, however, you know, if you look at it programmatically, Rupert Murdoch, the controlling owner of 21st Century Fox, the parent company, Roger Ailes himself, decided after the 2012 elections, looking at Mitt Romney's inability to pull sufficient Latino votes, they decided their nominees needed to be more sympathetic to immigration as a way of signaling to Latino voters that the Republicans would be viable. And again, this is a much more explicitly political calculation than, you know, media executives in major legacy news organizations tend to go for. I mean, you're not seeing the people at CNN make policy decisions like this in quite this way. But at Fox News, that's where they were. So this was a little uncomfortable. But that first debate, you know, Donald Trump did something very different than any Republican did. He made it about him versus Fox News as opposed to him versus the other Republican candidates. So there are a couple consequences of that, one of which is it elevates him and it depresses the interest of what any of the other candidates has to say, because there's been this electric confrontation between Trump and Megyn Kelly, who is their number two audience draw, but is really their number one emerging star, which is itself a source of friction with Bill O'Reilly, who's their number one star since really pretty much their inception. So that's an issue. And Roger Ailes doesn't really know what to do with it. Donald Trump basically says, hey, I may be a Republican figure in the lead in the polls, but I'm not going to kowtow to Fox. Well, Ailes is used to all kinds of deference from Republicans, whether or not they're the front runners. They may grumble and complain. Rick Santorum certainly did. Mitt Romney certainly did. But they all sat down repeatedly with anchors. They all sat down repeatedly. They wanted to do whatever they could because the Fox viewership is seen as sort of the core Republican voter. And guess what? Donald Trump's like, you know what? I can go on CNN anytime I want. I can go on all kinds of talk radio shows. I can go on to Rush. I can go on to all kinds of shows across the country. I can go on to MSNBC Morning Joe. I can go on to multiple shows multiple times a day. I don't need Fox as much. I'll go on the Today Show. I'll go on Morning America. I can do it in my bathrobe because these guys will take me by phone. They're so desperate to get me all the time. And I will do it every day. And therefore, Fox wants to play ball. Fox doesn't want to play ball. This is just, that is what most of anything caused havoc in Fox News, because they are used to dictating the terms of discourse, particularly for Republican politics. And especially with major political guests. And so what he did is without precedent there as well. And so that's been fascinating. He can send out a tweet to his now 7 million followers that drives news coverage for 36 hours and not appear on Fox One. Mm.
And David, coming full circle here, I'm going to ask you to give two grades, if you will. I know it's a little simplistic, but if you could give an overall grade to the media on how they're covering this election, and then a separate grade for NPR.
Good golly.
Yeah.
The media is so vast a collection. It's like grading an ocean, you know, that borders on many different continents. There are people who are doing great work, and there are people who are just feeding the beast. And every now and then, those are the same people. But I think that we are not surrounding our coverage of this race with enough context and enough enterprise and enough insight and enough testing and enough challenging and enough appreciating of these figures for who they are and what they can bring to counteract these sort of raw and filtered, you know, it's as though we're just giving live streams for everything Trump is doing. I do think that you're seeing more of Sanders and Clinton than you might otherwise, and you can certainly see extended excerpts of them as well. And particularly online, you can find all kinds of stuff anywhere. But I think that the way the press is operating, because there's so much of it, it requires much more of us as consumers to be thoughtful citizens and to go and seek out this stuff and to really look hard for it. And to make sure that we're getting enough information, and that when we see a charge levied or a surprising conclusion reached by analysts or reporters or what have you, that we go and test it against other sources of information and see if it holds up, and particularly original source material. In terms of NPR, you know, I would say that I think that my colleagues are doing their best to cover both the candidates, the issues, and also the regions, the terrain in which these contests are being waged. You know, the nice thing about us is that Our website is free. Our content is all there. It's all searchable. It's easily searchable. It's one of the most user-friendly news websites out there. And so, it's there in perpetuity. So people should go and find things at the times of day that make sense for them, or, not just listen to NPR, not just listen to VPR, listen to NPR One as they're on the go, but find ways to find coverage that is meaningful for them. But, the news comes to you, and you've also got to go to the news. It's a frustrating political season, but it's also a pretty electric one. When you have figures like Trump and when you have figures like Bernie Sanders, it really enlivens and I think enriches the debate, even as in some ways on the Republican side, I think in particular, the discourse has been terribly degraded. I think that's something in which journalism has participated as well.
David Folkenflik is NPR's media correspondent and author of the book Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you, David. Thank you.
You bet.